Okay, so first thing, I note that there have been two kinds of talks. Ones where people have trouble with their computers and people who use Macintosh. okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk, and particularly to give a talk on a subject in which I'm a complete beginner. I'm, as you may have gathered, as many people here know, I've been hanging around with this group of people for a very long time, for decades. But unlike them, I have just started looking at biological systems. And as a result, there are various things, various reactions that I'm going to be talking about that I have to this research, which are probably things that people get over very quickly. One is that I hope you'll forgive an abysmal ignorance of basic biology, which I hope will not become evident, but don't press me too hard. The other is, let me show you a picture of what I'm going to be talking about. Okay, this is a highly malignant brain tumor. This is what I'm going to be talking about. And this is a picture which I first saw at a conference in Beijing. Several people here were there. That Tom Dice spoke, I should mention him a little bit more. This fellow, whose address takes up half a slide, is my collaborator. He will be here in Santa Barbara later, I forget when, in October,
December,
to talk about these kinds of things in more detail. So I have been working in pattern formation for a very long time, and like many people here, I've had this, you know, sort of gusto and find that there's this sort of remarkable and beautiful patterns, and that's one of the sort of aesthetic attractions in working in the field. This is a pattern of very much the same type, except that it's far from beautiful. This is a truly horrifying object, and let me tell you why. This is a picture of a brain tumor in a artificial medium, which I'll talk about in a minute. It's glioblastoma multiforme, I've learned that phrase, which is the worst kind of brain tumor. It is, 23% of primary brain tumors are of this type, so it's shockingly common. It is a tumor such that the mean time of survival of people in the age group of people in this room is 6 months after diagnosis, and the five-year survival rate is 2%. Now, so this is a horrible disease. And why is it a horrible disease? It's a horrible disease because of the pattern, the way this pattern forms. Now, so that's one thing I want to say, and I'll say a good deal about how this pattern forms, because that's the whole point of the exercise, which I'll try to go into. All right, so that's one point. The second point is that when I looked at this pattern, those of you who remember Benny's talk, other talks, you've seen DLA patterns, I looked at this, I said, I know what that is. And it looks like things I've been working on, and that's what attracted me into the field. As we'll see, it is entirely different. It has nothing to do, well, it has something to do, but not much to do with DLA. And it is a different kind of pattern forming, a different kind of pattern forming system with its own interest and its own...
Yeah,
that I'm going to say in great detail what this is all about and what this is. Okay, so that was the second thing. All right, now, what is this thing? This is a tumor. This is what in the jargon is called an MTS, a multicellular tumor sphere, which is about 400 microns across. The way that it has been explained to me that these tumors grow is the following, that all brain tumors more or less start out the same way. Primary brain tumors, you start out with one of these spheres and it grows. In benign tumors, as many of you know, benign tumors are not so benign because they're in your brain, but they just grow, and they grow for a while, and after a while they exert pressure on the brain, and if a surgeon can take them out, then, you know, some people just start over and get another one, but anyway, it's not horrible. You can survive it. These guys do something quite different. These guys grow for a while, presumably exert pressure on the brain. Some sort of signal is sent to the cells, as they proliferate in that tumor. By the way, I should note that this tumor, as it grows, is dying inside because it can't get enough nutrient. That's typical of these tumors. They grow very quickly, and the nutrient can't get in. Something happens. I don't know what it is, and I don't think it is known. To convert the cells, these guys out here are the same kind of cell. They're the cells from the tumor. But instead of continuing to proliferate, they start to move. So you either grow or you go. Okay? So the proliferation rate of these guys out here, these invasive cells, is very low, whereas the proliferation rate of these guys in the tumor is quite high. So the tumor, and in fact, the way these things work is that you have the tumor, which grows for a while. This mysterious signal gets sent. It starts to send out these invasive cells. They grow for a while. The tumor more or less stops growing. The invasive zone gets large, presumably makes the brain, the extracellular matrix of the brain, fragile so that the tumor can grow some more. And then the tumor grows, and then the invasive cells grow. These invasive cells are the nasty ones. These are single cells. You see these. Here is a close-up of them. These branches, which is what I'm going to be talking about, are one cell wide, and they spread out. These are the nasty ones in the sense that if you try to operate on this tumor, this is what my friend Tom tells me, you can take it out, but you can't get these. And they move very quickly. And they're multiclonal, so when you start bombarding the brain with radiation or chemotherapy, it gets some but not others, and you make super tumors because, you know, you have kind of accelerated Darwinian evolution. They gather together and make secondary tumors. Sometimes they go into the spinal cord, and that's what kills you. And so it's the invasion. It's the invasion which is the interesting feature of this growth. And it's the invasion, and in particular, the growth of those pathways along which these cells move, which is what I'm going to focus on. So we've heard a lot of wonderful things about the brain. This is how you destroy one. And so here we go. All right, so let's see what we can say about it. Now, okay, so I just want to repeat the main points that I've said so far. They form complex growth patterns. You have proliferation, then invasive spread, then it can turn on again. And then you grow this central spheroid, and then you get the invasion. And this is the terrible thing, is the invasion. Okay, so that's the issue. Now, I want to go back for a moment to say a little bit more about this picture, because I haven't told you how we took this picture. This is not in a brain. This is in a medium called Matrigel, which I understand is well known to physicians or medical scientists, where you can grow these things artificially. It is a transparent gel. It is alleged to be sufficiently like the extracellular matrix of the brain that you can trust some of these results to having something to do with the brain. Some of this has been tested, can be seen in vivo, but everything I'm going to be talking about is in vitro in this experiment. What this group at Massachusetts General Hospital does is they make little millimeter-sized cubes. They put this Matrigel in a liquid form. They seed a tumor in there, allow it to solidify, and then it can grow. And you have to put carbon dioxide in, the usual tricks of growing cells. And it grows for a while, and you can watch it. And we're going to be watching it. And in the end of the talk, I'm going to be talking about some experiments done in Dave Waitz's lab at Harvard, where he watches this growth with confocal microscopy. Yes?
When you say it grows, are the cells at the edges dividing to make more cells?
And the cells on...
Are they corrupting the cells?
No, they're moving. They're moving. There are no cells out here. This is just gel.
That's just gel.
It's just gel. These guys are marching along, and more of them are shed from the tumor. I don't know if you can see this. Probably not, but you, yeah.
In the other picture, there's a grating. What is the cell?
This is the cell. There are a number of cells in that picture.
So you said the cells were the same. Now, they're the same in terms of originally, but for example, are their genetic expressions very different when it starts to march along like that?
Yeah, so yeah, that's what's believed. Some genetic signal comes
and it changes
it changes its habit. Yes. Okay. And it starts to call. Let me just say one more thing about Matrigel. Matrigel is a witch's brew, which is proprietal, so nobody knows what's in it, but it is believed to have lots of collagen and some nutrients. I mean, the company just won't tell. So, yes. Pardon me?
They're not masculine, right? They don't have...
Right.
So how relevant is this in the context of real cancer? In other words, the cancer really has to grow a size that's relatively large and become vascularized before it can...
Not so much in the brain as I understand it. Not so much in the brain. These are different. Brain tumors are quite different.
So they nevertheless still limited in size by diffusion.
Indeed. You can see it. I mean, this guy's dying. That's what these guys do. They run out and form secondary tumors. Okay? And there are experiments, which I won't show you, where you inject the Matrigel with some extra nutrients, and these cells will agglomerate and form the beginning of a secondary tumor somewhere else.
So in other words, you can get a lot of these little ones, you can never get a big one, because they'll always...
No, they'll eventually vascularize, as you say. I mean, but, you know, these things do grow large eventually. But the point is, they grow large lots of places, and you can't kill them. Is there another question?
Yeah, I mean, in the brain, there's not that free space, so there's all packed full of little cells. So how does it grow inside there? That's free space, right?
So. That's not free space. That's a gel. It's supposed to be like the extracellular matrix of the brain. Yes, there are other, you know.
But there are very little gaps between the cells of the brain. So are they growing those gaps?
I don't know very much about that. I'm not sure what is known. I'm going to tell you about this model system.
Okay.
Yes. I'm going to come to that. Yeah, they eat up the material. They digest it, if you will. Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's the problem. It's a nasty one, and we're going to try to figure out, from the point of view of pattern formation, from the point of view of physics, how do these guys move? You know, and among the things that they do when they move is digest the secrete stuff, which makes the gel fall apart, even in this model system, and other things, which we're going to try to investigate. Okay, so let me just mention something. Eschel also mentioned this resemblance fallacy. Eschel will recognize this picture, which I stole from his homepage. This is what got me going. This looks rather like a DLA pattern, but this is a bacteria colony. And it sort of looks like what we saw before. And when I got interested in this, I whipped up a DLA simulation, looked exactly like that picture that you saw in the first slide, and I sent it to Tom, and I said, well, maybe this is it. And he sent back, well, that's very interesting, but it isn't it, and I'll explain why. By the way, this is not just a mistake that physicists make. The only other model, you know, real model in the literature that I found for the growth of these GBMs makes exactly this mistake, which I'm about to describe. Because what happens in DLA, what happens in these bacteria colonies, is that these tips grow when they're better nourished, grossly speaking, and it's the enhanced proliferation which leads to this branching and the spreading out. But the enhanced proliferation, nothing like that occurs. The basic biology of the tumor is quite different. What happens, we believe mediated indeed by nutrient and the same sort of instabilities that you can get in DLA growth or bacteria colony growth, is that it enhances the mobility, enhances the pumping out of these cells along the branches rather than the proliferation, and that's led to some interesting things which we're going to talk about. So again, for GBM, the invasive cells move, and the invasive cells are produced at the MTS.
Well, there is a bacterial pattern which is very similar to what you described, which is the Proteus. swarming pattern where it grows a ring and then it differentiates into a new type of bacteria that can then invade new areas. So maybe we should talk about that afterwards. But
yeah, okay.
It's the wrong divide.
What?
And they don't divide.
And they don't divide, right.
Okay, well.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that's extremely similar. Let me just say one more thing. I don't think it's only my ignorance, which I freely admit. Much less is known about this kind of cell than about the things we've been hearing earlier in the week. I mean, this is a pretty new field, or it's absolutely new to me. But I don't believe that the detailed kinds of information that we got earlier in the week about, you know, bacteria is available for these kinds of tumor cells. One of the purposes of the enterprise which I've engaged in with Tom and others is to try to figure things out. By the way, let me just say one more thing before I forget. We think we're funded by the NIH for this. My impression of the NIH, this is also as a newcomer of the field, is that you fund fundamental ideas, basic kinds of research when all else fails. This is a disease for which all else has failed, so that they're willing to let us look at the mechanisms, the underlying mechanisms. Thank you. And anyway, we think we have a grant, and I'm looking for a postdoc to work on this stuff. So if anyone knows a student who's interested, let me know. Okay, so what do? We try to model. Now I'm going to commit all the sins we heard about earlier in the week. We consider that there are two ways in which cells want to move in this material. They are affected by chemotaxis. They want to move towards nutrients. That's been demonstrated. I told you about this little experiment that has been demonstrated for these materials. The center of the cell, that MTS is already eating up a lot of the nutrients, so the invasive cells have to move out to get some food. All right, so that's one thing. There is some evidence, though it is not terribly solid, that there's another effect which leads to the growth of these branches. This is called paracrine production, that one of these tumor cells, when it's moving, attracts others. I'm going to take that as a hypothesis. That could lead, and I'll show you, will lead in the model I'm about to describe, to the formation of branch structures. That's one point that we can make. However, there's something else, and that's what was just mentioned. There can be tissue damage by the invading cells. They eat. Now, these are 10 micron cells going through a gel whose mesh size is 1 micron. They've got to do something to get through, and what they do is they generate some proteolytic enzymes which eat up the collagen and make a pathway for them. And presumably what happens is that pathway exists, the other cells can go down that pathway. So it's like an ant trail. Yes? Okay. So I'll show you some experiments that have recently been done, not published, about those pathways at the end of the talk. This model, by the way, was published in Physiology of E, which Herbie tells me is a proof of, what did you say, an admission of defeat. Okay, so here are two things I'm going to do. I'm going to show you that, at least in principle, this mechanism can work. I'm going to make a continuum model which shows that branch formation can come out when you have this chemotaxis moving the cells this way, but the cells as they move along will attract one another, and I'll show that they'll attract into branches using the traditional techniques of our field, namely linear stability analysis. Then I will go on to do something else which I've done many times, namely talk about discrete simulation, basically a biased random walker simulation. Think of the cells as little guys that just hop on a lattice, hop around, and they hop around attracted by the nutrient, and they can hop most easily where there are these damage pathways, and we'll see if we get the right pattern. Okay, so here are some things about continuum modeling. What I need is an equation which is going to describe the motion of the tumor cells. The tumor cells are called C, their concentration is called C, and they have a diffusion coefficient which presumably depends on position, because you can have these damage pathways, and then you have the nutrient chemotaxis, and then the drift due to the other factor, which I call H, the thing that attracts cells to one another. So N is a nutrient supplied from outside, typically glucose, and the H is just something else. Okay, and I use a sort of typical thing I get out of the literature for the chemotaxis coefficient. This has been measured actually for these very cells. Yes?
But unlike other cancers, in this location you don't have any inhibitor. You don't have any effective immune response that would come to.
That's right. That's right. Certainly in this situation. Yes, that's right. Okay. So we have two kinds of drift. The nutrient satisfies a nice diffusion equation, and it's just the usual thing. And a lot of these coefficients are known. Okay? This has been measured. This is just the diffusion coefficient of glucose in the brain, which is known. And the third thing, however, is this homotype factor, this guy H, which is not even identified. So we don't know anything about it. So I am now committing the sin that we talked about earlier yesterday in some detail. There are a whole raft of unknown parameters in this model, okay, which I've grouped into dimensionless groups, but we just don't know very much about them. Okay, so nevertheless, I will continue by telling you a little about them. First thing, this is an easily knowable parameter, but no one's ever measured it to my knowledge. Namely, if you have one of these active cells, it must have, I mean, like any other object which is moving, it must have some random motion if you don't do anything to it. And it must move in response to chemotaxis. Chemotaxis is known. The random motion has never been measured except in a fake measurement, which assumes the wrong model. So I won't talk about that. But there was a deduction. People deduced a diffusion coefficient for these very cells, assuming that they proliferate instead of move. I won't go into this, but I can discuss it later. So what we do is take some parameters, guess some parameters, and hope that we can eventually measure them. So to start, what I try to do is a stability analysis. That is to say, I take the following geometry. Everything is in two dimensions at the moment. I take a channel on which the nutrient is flowing this way. The cells are flowing this way. Yes? And in steady state, the cells would just flow. The nutrient would flow. The cells would eat the nutrient, and that you would have a nice steady state. And you would also, there's also, if you include this guy H, you secrete H, and it reaches some steady level, it's produced and it decays, and if you have periodic boundary conditions, nothing else happens. And that's a nice steady state, a reference state, which is, of course, unstable because the cells want to move together. Yes? So I have an unstable steady state, and I linearized around the unstable steady state in the conventional manner, which I write down here. And what I get is the following. The x direction is along the channel, the y direction is across the channel, and you find that you have instability as required, more unstable along the y direction and along the x direction. That is to say, you more quickly go together than you move this way, and this translates in the following way. If we take an initial lump above the steady state, an initial lump of tumor cells, they develop into this branch. So, at least in principle, our mechanism is working. So, what I did next is try to do a discrete simulation model. And this is, you can think of this as a cellular automaton that we heard about before, but it's stochastic. I just take a random walk, a biased random walk, which is well known to describe diffusion equations, and I try to describe the bias gives you the chemotaxis, and I try to describe the motion in that way. Now, I do something a little different here. I do something a little different here, namely I describe it with, I just increase the diffusion, I just increase the diffusion coefficient where a cell has ever been, and that's supposed to describe the damage that the cell gets. Okay, so here's some results.
So the continuum model of that would be different than the one you actually wrote down.
That's correct. That's correct, yes. So, if you have weak chemotaxis and weak homotype attraction, the cells just spread out diffusively and then nothing much happens. If you have strong chemotaxis without much homotype attraction, then you have a cloud of cells, which is not observed. And...
not
connected? No. Wait. If I put on strong homotype attraction, then I start to get branches. Okay? You need both. You need the homotype attraction to get branches. There's no reason for cells to in this model to be connected. Okay, so that's what I want to say. Now, I want to very quickly go through a few experimental results. So this is as far as we got for modeling. The model seems to have the right ingredients, but let me just say a little bit about what we're beginning to understand in further work, which is some of which is in press and some of which is unpublished, is what these cells might be actually doing to the extracellular matrix of the brain and to the gel, which is what we experiment on, to try to figure out what's happening. So what do the cells do? Well, the first thing I thought of when I started talking to Tom about it is they start to mechanically deform the gel, and they possibly can tear the gel. That would be one mechanism for forming these pathways independent of what was mentioned before of chemically digesting. Okay? These are rather soft materials we're dealing with. There's a suggestion in the literature that we are following up about remodeling the gel. There are a collection of collagen fibers in the gel. The cells pull on those collagen fibers and rearrange them. So let's look at these things. There is the paper that I'm quoting with. I am not an author, but this is an experimental paper. And let me just tell you what you do. You put a bunch of little beads in the gel, and you track them with time-lapse photography. The color coding is blue is early, red is late. So if you look at a little here, you have blue here, red out here. It means that this, which is the MTS, is pushing the beads out, and you're exerting pressure. So everything's sort of moving out in this picture, which is what you expect. However, if you have one of these invasive cells, which vaguely shows up here, you see that it is, in fact, attracting. It is pulling on the beads. As it crawls, as these cells crawl on the fibers, they exert tractions. Okay? Here's a nicer example. Here's the tip of a cell marked with the arrow. And you look, and the MTS is over there. Look at this nice dipole pattern. You're pulling here, pushing out here, and you make a nice dipole pattern for the stress, which is kind of interesting. Okay, so that's one set of experiments. These experiments are not published. These are experiments where you image the collagen fibers. Here's a cell which is pulling on the fibers, and you see it gathers them together. It's pulling them. Now, the suggestion that we're following up is that by pulling on the fibers, you'll make kind of pathways through which the cells along which the cells can move, and we can see here is the outline of the cell, and you see this concentration of fibers at its tip as it moves along. Okay, so this is some final points. These cells, as they crawl along, are exerting stresses on the gel, which are really rather large, and they are comparable to the yield strength of the gel. So they can, in fact, tear it. And if they tear it, if they make fracture paths, then that could be a mechanism for letting these pathways form. There's also this thing that's been mentioned. And the actual interaction is rather complex. And needless to say, it has to be sorted out, which we hope to do. Now, I'm over time. However, while I'm answering questions, I will do what is absolutely required in this conference. I'll show you a movie.
Attempt to show a movie.
No, this is a Macintosh, Herbie. Okay. This is the cell. You can barely see it. It's right here, and it is pulling on the fibers. And if you focus on one fiber, you can see the fibers moving. This one here, being pulled in. And if you see. Okay. So, thank you very much.
So why does your model have a bulk? Why doesn't your model have a bulk instability? You, after all, have this signaling, this release of the signaling agent that then is driving the cells towards that signal. Your whatever you call the paracrine agent or something H.
Yes.
So even in the bulk, that should cause the system to break up into highly dense spots. That's the same. That's basically, aside from your nutrient part, that's the standard model of chemotactic-induced.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
absolutely.
So it would do that. I mean, because your bulk is not doing anything in your simulation.
No, it would. No, in the continuum, it absolutely would. If I would turn off the nutrient, the point is that the instability, which you're absolutely right, would grow. You know, you make a little bump, it'll grow. Is advected by the nutrient field. I mean, it's affected. It's not hydrodynamics, but it's pulled along by the nutrient field.
I wondered whether there is real evidence that the cells that grow, really eat or damage the matrix.
You mean the ones that move?
Yeah, the reason I'm asking it is because you know that it might be another scenario that might one may think is that they just. Find their pathways through the gel, which is and you know there are models of viscous fingering or DLA in viscoelastic material that look much more the branches are much sharper and look much similar to this one rather than the usual DLA. So it might be that
the real answer is I have to depend on people who are expert in this field, and there's considerable evidence in the literature. I mean, this is an old story. That these proteases are produced, and you do in fact damage the material. I don't think that's actually controversial.
In these experiments, what you're looking at is depth averaged measurement, is it?
No, this is confocal microscopy.
Okay, so these tumors are embedded in three dimensions.
Yes. There's a little. Let me say a little. There's this little millimeter-sized cube in the middle of which is one of these multicellular spheres, and in the first picture, which is just sort of an advertising picture we put in our grant proposal, in fact, they made the cells grow in two dimensions by having a two layers of gel. But in the real experiments that I'm talking about, and all the real experiments. The MTS is put into the gel while it's still liquid. It's allowed to solidify, so it's really a three-dimensional model. Yes.
Have you tried, or your collaborators have tried to actually play with the concentration of filaments, or cross-linking, or entanglement to see?
That's one of the things. One of the things we want to do. The trouble with working with Matrigel, of course, is you buy it and that's it. I mean, one of the things is we're trying to figure out is whether we want to cook our own medium, which, you know, it has its own problems. That's right. That's right. But that doesn't, you know, that's not a trivial matter. These media are, you know, that's why you can patent one and sell it at fast cost. Is that having a medium which will keep these things alive and allow things to spread is, you know. But yeah, that's certainly a direction to go. Right, you want to change the collagen concentration, you want to change the nutrient concentration. What we'd really like to do is image a nutrient, yes? To see if we're really dealing with chemotaxis of the type I described.
Len, I can offer you another substrate, and this is a culture network of real neuron and glia, and you can put a tumor on and see how it behaves, not only how it behaves and if it eats the glia, but it will be nice to see if it eats the glia, for example, how the electrical activity of the network will change and if it will be correlated, we see.
I don't know why, Eshel, that sounds perverse. You have this beautiful system, now you want to give it cancer.
We can add some immune cells and see a competition.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get my head around the attractant and the chemotaxis. Do you ever see the pathways merge as they're evolving out of the tumor?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I didn't show you time-lapse photography. You bet. I mean, you see the MTS and, you see it there and there's nothing, and then you see these things growing, and after a while the invasive zone is quite large, and you can watch it grow, and absolutely it grows on pathways.
But the pathways merge back together.
Sometimes. Oh, I see what you mean. Do you have loops? Yes, sometimes.
Then the other question is, I'm not familiar with the literature on crawling cells responding to external stresses. Is that an orienting effect on cells? Like if you pull on a cell, does it start crawling on in the direction of the pull? Could these things be talking through, stress?
I mean, that's possible. Our model is quite different. Our model is that they're crawling along a static nutrient gradient. Now, of course, all this wonderful stuff. Yeah, it's a biology question. I don't really know the answer.
Well, they also don't grow as perfect spheres all the time. You'll see budding with kind of daughter tumors from these particular tumors at times, and sometimes if you biopsy them, they'll just start to run up the track that you left in the wake of the small needle.
In answer to your question, there is a phenomenon called traction-based morphogenesis, which Jorge Oscar Merkel has beautiful stuff about, where literally stress on the underlying matrix actually causes growth patterns favorable to that. But it's not universal, and it's far from clear that that's what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a question connected to a previous one. So in principle, if you discretize the model, if you could assign to each point a certain dipole or quadrupole, elastic quadrupole, then each point elsewhere will be directed towards an elastic. It will feel the elastic field and then guided by the elastic field.
Sure. You mean put the elasticity right into the simulation model? We haven't done that. That's certainly one of the things we want to do. Yes, and yeah. I mean, that's one of the points of these experiments. If we can describe, if we find that in some macroscopic way, it's far from clear how to model this, in some macroscopic way, once you've pulled on the medium, it gets easier to to move that. Yes, absolutely. That's the sort of thing we'd like to do.
So think of the difference between this and the HIV talk. If this was a virus, it's gorgeously engineered. It would simply get large enough to break open the head and then go out and spill and get onto other people and do this. It's perfectly engineered to be destructive, and it doesn't have any purpose. It simply kills its host and then it dies itself. The difference teleologically, how does that differ from HIV? These things, we think, had no selective pressure against them. They're a genome and a cell system just gone out of control, but you never had any pressure on the human organism to really have to get more than about 30 years of age, and these things don't start to really kick in and peak in incidence until much later in life, until you're about the age of half of us in the room. And there's, from an evolutionary point of view, there's not much reason for us to be around anymore.
So the question is, my question, a teleological question, how do they get to be so clever? I mean, presumably they've hijacked something which is already there.
Why would it be an accident? Maybe there's a good reason to get rid of us before we hang around too long. I don't know.
Just a general, maybe naive question. Do your findings on the nature of these pathways suggest a treatment at all, or are you not with that?
Well, of course, that's the idea. Right. He wanted to know if this has any clinical consequences, this is a horrible disease, could we do something about it? Now, the dream is that if we can understand these pathways, can understand the invasion, maybe a surgeon can go in and catch them. I didn't write that part of the grant proposal, but we're trying to understand, and maybe something will come up. I mean, this is, by the way, I make no apology, this is applied research. If we stumble on something fundamental, so much the better. But the point is that this is something that we're forced to look at the basics of this because no one has any idea what to
do. Well, I give a slightly alternative answer, maybe. What you don't want to do is come up with a better surgical approach. In the 1920s, a fellow named Dandy decided that they're so lethal, I'll just take half the brain out. With enough skill, you can take half a brain out. If you do it in an adult, it's not a good outcome. But the person can survive and be conscious. And they all died in the same time frame that you mentioned, about half a year, or at that time, maybe 17 or 20 weeks. So the idea, I would think, is to find some factor, let's say, that's pulling these out and pharmacologically be able to interfere with these tendons.
Being applied the research, now you have the model in your disposal. What happens, for example, in the model if you add the source of H at the center of the tumor? Would it cause it to stop branching out, but collapse in, and then it can be surgery?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or, for example, you inject inside both H and glucose, which usually they would not do before the operation, and then it will cause the cells to move inside back.
Yeah.
Then you can take it out.
Absolutely. No, that's an
interesting. Do it in the model easily.
Of course. No ethical problem.
Is there any connection between these phenomena and angiogenesis that happens in other cancers?
The way I understand it, and here I may get shot down, is that angiogenesis plays less of a role in brain tumors than in other tumors. And my belief is that, I've been shot down, but we've not considered angiogenesis.
My question is the same sort of mechanisms does the things that you're modeling here, can that modeling also apply to angiogenesis?
Sure.
Actually, this tumor doesn't vascularize very much. They don't bleed a lot when you take them out. Other types vascularize extensively.
Okay, so I'm not completely wrong.
No, you're okay. You're safe with this tumor.
My question is, are the sort of genetic mechanisms that cause the pathways to be created in angiogenesis, are those related to what's happening in this tumor?
My belief is, the little I know about angiogenesis is that there is a vaguely similar kind of instability, which leads to the growth of blood vessels towards the tumor. So in some impressionistic sense, it's related, yes.
I have two quite disparate questions. The first one concerns invading cells. Does one know whether they become stiffer before they crawl? For example, it's well known that many cells which are lacking certain protein, they cannot undergo certain gel salt transformation inside, and then they cannot crawl.
Yes.
Does one have any information about the mechanical response of the invading cells?
Between the stuff in the tumor and the,
Right.
I don't, but that's a very interesting question. I don't know. It's quite possible. You mean that they would sort of learn to crawl, they would develop some sort of skeleton.
That's
interesting, and I don't know. It could be, it's knowable, I suppose.
Okay. The other question is technical. In the continuum model, what introduces a cutoff for the in the spectrum, linear spectrum that you have shown? Because I do not see any cutoff introduced in the model.
It's a diffusion.
It's
coming between up and down and creating.
I think you may have answered this back at the beginning, but you had said that this is very different than other brain tumors that don't show the branching. And from your model then, can one sort of infer that a key issue, the other ones never make the individual cells that move on their own?
Well, of course, I can't infer that from the model. That's what people tell me.
But that's what people say. So you don't even have the situation where they could possibly make tracks because you don't even have cells that are moving individually.
My understanding about benign brain tumors is that they just grow. And they don't, these invasive guys just don't occur.
If I can try to broaden this discussion then for the next 5 minutes, I'm told after 5 minutes we all have to run to lunch. You've seen this morning two neural systems and two disease systems. The physics should be very different, and in some general senses that have been talked about at the meeting. The neural systems, with the possible exception of some single neuron type cultures, which we weren't talking about this morning, the neural systems all have excitatory and inhibitory neurons in them. And you get dynamical Turing instabilities in those systems because there are activators and inhibitors that tend to give you, with perturbations, localized areas of activity. In HIV, there weren't inhibitors other than death. I guess death is an inhibitor, isn't it? The inhibitor in your system was essentially death of those cells. So you had instabilities in the patterns from cellular death. This thing has no instability. If you actually didn't have the skull, I suspect it would simply uniformly distribute eventually throughout the brain and look like one of Eschel's experiments run overnight or for several days.
It has a pattern-forming instability. It makes the branches.
Yeah, but if you ran it for a long time, if you could, these things might just homogeneously fill up.
Eventually,
brain.
I suppose, yeah.
Which people have tried, in a sense. They've tried putting viruses in that would be killer viruses and be taken up and perhaps lethally affect.
Yes, cells in the brain come originally from the same place that the immune system cells come. So have it been observed? Yeah, some of the glia, the microglia come originate in the embryonic, what? The microglia, refer to. Okay. Have it been observed that microglia, for example, will change the role in the case or in the presence of some of these and then will act against it?
The microglia are highly active against HIV infection. This type of cancer, to my knowledge, there's almost no activation of the microglia. They're happy to have these things crawl out and invade distally in the brain, which is why they do. I don't know what they eat.
I think they eat. I mean, in the experiment, do we think they eat glucose? Yeah, what do you mean?
They have metal food. Do they still go back to the glucose or to tell the metal food?
That's what
it is. Exposed to the field, they prefer to digest the glucose.
You're asking the wrong person.
We're decaying, and we're going to find our own glucose supply then to re-energize our glia. Thank you.